Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Ravi Chandraj, counsel for appellant, the estate of Lacey Lloyd Thomas. This case is about a wrongful denial of justice. Mr. Thomas spent the last decade of his life under a cloud of suspicion after being subjected to a highly dubious prosecution by Scott Mitchell, the former chief deputy district attorney for Clark County, Nevada. The prosecution was dismissed after a judicial finding that Mr. Mitchell committed a, quote, egregious Brady violation. By that point, Mr. Thomas's life and career had already been destroyed, but Mr. Thomas never received a remedy. The district court prematurely ended Mr. Thomas's pursuit of justice based on three errors of law. First, the district court erroneously dismissed the malicious prosecution claim against Mr. Mitchell with prejudice, based on an extremely overbroad interpretation of prosecutorial immunity.
Wait a minute. I'm going to stop you there because before the district court, plaintiff's counsel acknowledged that the complaint, as it was then drafted, did not include any allegations of sort of administrative conduct. That was all within the scope of Mr. Mitchell's role as a prosecutor, which is subject to absolute immunity. So that concession was made. And then what I understood you to argue in your briefs was, oh, because it was a dismissal with prejudice, that was wrong and we should have been given an opportunity to amend the complaint.
That's correct, Your Honor. We acknowledge
that. But you were. I mean, didn't the district court say, I would allow them to seek to add an amendment to add Mr. Mitchell at a later date, have a colloquy with counsel and explain it would be narrow, but they could come back and seek to make that amendment because they were still in discovery?
Yes, Your Honor, but that doesn't change the fact that the claim was dismissed as a formal matter with prejudice, meaning that any challenge to that, I mean, filing an ordinary leave to amend a complaint when the claim has been dismissed with prejudice, that's a hard thing to do.
The court had invited you. The court had said explicitly on the record in the colloquy with counsel, discovery is still ongoing.
But there's still no obligation.
It's a narrow avenue, but you can come back and ask to amend. But the plaintiff's counsel never did. Why? Why did he not even come back and make the attempt to amend?
Well, I wasn't involved, but I believe it was because the avenue was so narrow based on the court's ruling on the record that, you know, basically, you know, it's a fishing expedition.
Could it have been because they didn't discover any facts to make that allegation?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it was because the district court in its transcript said, now, this is like, it's incredibly narrow. It's almost theoretical. The court misread the scope of prosecutorial immunity. So advocate.
In what way? I mean,
because the court said
that the role of an advocate as a prosecutor doesn't fall within the immunity.
No, the court said that the exceptions are incredibly narrow and almost theoretical, which is just not correct. It's a functional question. It's whether you're engaged in investigative conduct. And the court, the reason that it said this is a dismissal with prejudice, instead of just doing the normal thing and saying, well, take discovery and come back to me, the court wanted to very narrowly limit the avenue for that because it overread the scope. And based on that, counsel was not under an obligation to thereafter file a leave to amend. He was entitled to appeal as we're doing now because the claim had formally been dismissed with prejudice. And the scope on the record, the court says it's almost theoretical. You can basically, there's nothing in the complaint. First of all, there was an allegation. It wasn't, now it may not have been specifically alleged sufficient to avoid a motion to dismiss, but there was an allegation that Mr. Mitchell was engaged in some investigatory conduct. Furthermore, the complaint attached evidence from the proceeding, the actual criminal proceeding, where the Nevada Supreme Court was recounting the hearing that took place, where the investigative arm of the state, the Metro, basically, testified on the subject of the Brady violation and said their sergeant had at least one conversation with the deputy district attorney where it was indicated that there was evidence that ACS had performed work at UMC. Now, ACS is count one of the indictment. After the grand jury returned an indictment containing charges related to ACS, the sergeant testified that he was surprised. So the investigators did not think there was any grounds to pursue a claim. This is before the indictment, before probable cause has been established.
But doesn't the prosecutor have the discretion to decide whether or not to pursue the claim? Right?
Well,
I mean, the police officers bring a ticket or may bring a charge to the prosecutor's office and they decline to prosecute. Isn't that in their traditional role as a prosecutor to decide whether or not to bring the claims?
I think if the prosecutor is substituting his own investigatory work for the investigators who are assigned by the state to investigate the claim, then we can't put it in the advocate function. And here we have an investigation that took place and said there is no grounds to prosecute him on this ACS contract. Now, we don't have, there's not a clear record on what happened because Mr. Mitchell did not testify at the Brady violation hearing, but we do know that after being told by the sergeant that, look, there's exculpatory evidence on this contract, he thereafter goes to the grand jury and presents a case that there should be probable cause. Now, this is before, when the Supreme Court is clear.
So what you're arguing, counsel, is that the prosecutor acted in bad faith or was negligent or violated the law. But those are not, that doesn't defeat immunity. It's absolute immunity. So when he goes to the grand jury and presents evidence, that's a classic function of a prosecutor. I'm really struggling to see how anything you're describing takes Mr. Mitchell's conduct, whether it was wrongful or if he was innocent, whatever it was, out of his role as a prosecutor.
Your Honor, I would submit that what the prosecutor did here was the collection of evidence on the first count. And the collection of evidence is investigation. That's not a traditional advocate function.
The prosecutor is required to analyze the evidence.
But there was no evidence on count one. The sergeant said there is not evidence to prosecute him on this claim.
So what you're alleging is that he was incorrect or malicious in how he analyzed the evidence or lack of evidence, but then decided to take it something to the grand jury and get an indictment.
The specific allegation that we would make in an amended complaint would be that he suppressed exculpatory evidence and presented his own evidence of why this person was guilty of a contract, where Metro is telling him, no, there is no evidence. In fact, there's exculpatory evidence.
So if there's an investigation, it sounds like a classic claim of malicious prosecution.
Your Honor, but in the role, what he's doing is he is substituting his investigative work for what Metro did, because there had to be some evidence submitted to the grand jury.
So how broad is the rule that a prosecutor can't conduct investigation? Can they interview witnesses?
They can, so long as they don't.
Isn't that investigative? Can they review documents to try to identify who might be witnesses that they should talk to?
They can, but if they're working hand in glove with the investigators, that's fine. But what he did was he contradicted his investigators. So if there is any evidence on count one, it could only have been provided by the prosecutor himself, not the investigators who are traditionally assigned to that role. So when you forego the actual investigative work by your investigators and you then present evidence to the grand jury, the necessary implication is, how did that investigation happen? It could not have been by the traditional investigators. It had to be by a prosecutor engaging in something outside of his advocacy role, because otherwise there would have been no evidence to present to the grand jury. The sergeant said, there's no evidence here. In fact, there's evidence that he's innocent of any charge on the ACS contract, exculpatory evidence. So the only way evidence could have been collected is solely through Mr. Mitchell performing a function outside of traditional advocacy. So that's why we feel that this case is outside the scope of prosecutorial immunity. At least there was a good faith basis to allege it, such that it shouldn't have been a with prejudice dismissal. Now, we could argue that maybe as a matter of strategy, yes, we could have filed a leave to amend in the court below. But we're not obligated to do that. Once a claim has been dismissed with prejudice, we are entitled to wait for judgment and then appeal the dismissal, because it's been dismissed with prejudice. That's a high burden to overcome, particularly when you look at the transcript, which says, look, I don't want you going on a fishing expedition for discovery. This is a very broad, the exceptions are narrow, almost theoretical. There's no evidence. And the ordinary case, when you don't think there's evidence, but you want to allow them to pursue discovery, is to dismiss without prejudice, because that allows the advocate to go out and ask questions and know that he's not going to get a protective order motion when he's trying to ask questions in a deposition or make discovery requests. It just adds to the burden of the rest of the case. And as the ultimate matter, there's no obligation to do that. You are entitled to appeal a dismissal with prejudice, which is what we're doing now. In any event, that was not the only error that the court committed below. Turning to the second error, the district court erroneously granted summary judgment to the county after holding that plaintiff failed to establish single instance Monell liability. The district court incorrectly ruled that single instance Monell liabilities is only applicable for life-threatening conduct by municipal employees. And the court cited a case called Benavides versus the City of San Diego for that point. That's a Ninth Circuit panel decision. But both the district court's decision and the Benavides decision contradict clear Ninth Circuit en banc precedent and Supreme Court precedent, demonstrating that there is no life-threatening conduct requirement for single-instance Monell liability, nor is that a workable rule. First of all, going to the precedent, there's a case, Kirkpatrick versus County of Washoe. It's an en banc case. It involved a child who had been seized without a warrant in a non-emergency setting. And despite the absence of a pattern of violations, the court found that the county could not succeed on summary judgment that there was a possibility that single instance Monell liability could be established.
So how do you distinguish Connick? So single instance liability has to arise from some failure on the part of the county defendant that creates an obvious consequence. So in Connick, it was failing to train officers on excessive force.
Right.
And they distinguish that from lawyers because lawyers have all sorts of other training and experience that they would understand the law, for example, their Brady obligations. So Connick seems to be right on point and to support the district court's grant of summary judgment.
Your Honor, the court in Connick did address lawyers, but it did say that the rule or the doctrine they were applying as to lawyers would apply absent specific circumstances. So unless you know that a particular lawyer is at risk, there's an obvious risk that this particular lawyer needs the training, you can't just rely on his the general requirements of the legal profession.
Right, and you argue, I read your briefs, you argue that the county should have known because of various aspects of Mr. Mitchell's personality. He was a racist. He did...
We don't allege that he's a racist. Well, we just said he had strong views,
et cetera.
Yeah.
But how would the county even know that? They have, as it was undisputed, they had a robust training program for Brady.
Well, there's testimony in Mr. Mitchell himself supplied the evidence. He testified that he had.
That's not the same question. He may have said things after the fact about what he assumed that Brady was being followed. They were self-enforcing because everybody would find out if you didn't do it and there'd be problems in the office. But that's not the same as saying the county knew he was going to violate Brady. But they have a robust training program.
But, Your Honor, our burden defending summary judgment is not to establish that the county knew.
To at least establish some facts.
There was a question of disputed fact that whether the county knew about these views that Mr. Mitchell no doubt had. He testified in his deposition that he was completely unfamiliar with any formal policy, however robust it was. I mean, it could be a 1,000-page policy. Mr. Mitchell had no idea what it said. He also testified that his understanding of the Brady policy was that it was self-enforcing, which means any failure to understand Brady would reveal itself through actual cases where defendants' actual rights were getting violated. That's what he testified that he understood the policy to be.
Right. I understand your argument, but the problem still remains that whatever he said he thought about the policy or his awareness of it doesn't reflect on what the county knew. There has to be some evidence that the county was aware of this to support your theory of how this was an obvious consequence for a single incident.
Well, drawing all inferences in the favor of...
What inferences? I mean, there's a view that he's
freely expressing that he is completely ignorant of the policy. There's also evidence that the county...
Well, he's freely expressing it in his deposition. Did you have some evidence that he...
Well, we also have evidence. We have evidence that the county...
He memo he told other employees.
Well, we do have evidence that the county knew that there was no enforcement mechanism for this policy, that there was no way to check whether any particular prosecutor would ever attend a training. So there's a general inference you could draw that any particular prosecutor who has strong views and maybe said something, I don't know, but you know that your prosecutors are not guaranteed to get training on Brady. So there's at least a risk that any particular prosecutor does not understand your policy because you're not checking.
Right,
and there is
no
enforcement.
You're at a minute 40 right now. Did you want to reserve the rest of your time?
Yeah, I will reserve the rest of my time. Thank you,
Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Tom Dillard on behalf of Clark County and Scott Mitchell. This case comes on appeal from two orders of the district court, two different jurists, one on the pleading stage, finding absolute immunity. The order in that case is the transcript that Your Honors have read, and the second from Judge Silva, a written order on Monell. I would submit to the court, both of these issues are center stage, garden variety issues that are governed by Supreme Court precedent on immunity and the rigorous Monell elements of deliberate indifference and direct moving causation. I want to comment on initially Your Honor's questions about there was a fair opportunity to amend. This is a protracted case. This case went on for years due to the unfortunate passing of Mr. Thomas. There was 10 years separating the deposition of of the retirement of Mr. Mitchell in his deposition. There was no evidence at all of any of the online chat examination brought in at the pleading stage or at the summary judgment stage. At the pleading stage, I think Your Honor rightfully pointed out, Judge Boulware had a conversation with counsel, and there was an agreement on the record. There's no investigative function alleged in the complaint. When he asked him, do you have any? His response was, nothing other than discovery is starting. It's just beginning. And then I think Your Honor's description of invitation is apt. There was an invitation. Well, if you learn something, if something comes up, I will entertain a motion to amend under Rule 15. So there was certainly an opportunity if they wanted to bring some investigative function allegation into the case to do so in the 5 years it was pending. It did not happen. And even now, there's no articulation of any investigative function. Really, what we have is the prosecutor, based on the factual record, or I should say information gathered by law enforcement, to exercise his legal judgment and ascertain what charges ought to apply, what should be taught, what should be taken to the grand jury. That is purely center stage prosecutorial function, advocacy. There's no evidence that he was out in the warrant application phase or being involved in any collection of physical evidence. The allegation is the law enforcement didn't specifically recommend a particular charge, but based on this collection of evidence, the prosecutor, using his law degree and his experience as the chief deputy, deemed it's that there was probable cause to bring it to the grand jury. Whether he was right, whether he was wrong, whether he did it with some jaundiced view does not matter for immunity. Absolute applies, and Judge Boulware was right in the sense of what's being alleged in this case. The absolute immunity is certainly a hearty defense and encompasses what's been alleged even today, even with 2020 hindsight with those orders. There's still nothing before the court in the face of an argument of an investigative function to pierce absolute immunity. So we would submit that the initial order at the pleading stage, never appealed, never brought up again, should stand on appeal. Your Honor, as to the Monell issue, I think the articulation really that was presented today is one that's through the ambit of negligence. The county should have figured it out. What should they have figured out? Well, 10 years after retirement, a former prosecutor is involved in chat view room and has political, expressing his political beliefs. Is there any evidence that the district attorney, the policymaker, knew it, that the county knew it? There's no evidence of that. There's no evidence that this was ever published or it was happening at the time. There's no evidence that this particular prosecutor had any other claims against him or complaints or had any other infringements upon the Brady requirement. So this really is a single instance issue. And you cannot draw through the Monell elements, rigorous as they are, on culpability of deliberate indifference and direct causation on a single instance. The court in Canton said, yeah, you can have a single instance if you send out law enforcement with service weapons and don't train them on deadly force, because it's so obvious. That argument was made in Connick. Certainly, the county had much more rigorous training than was in the record in Connick. They had an open file policy. The policy was the file is in the room. The defense could come look at every page. And they had there's evidence in the record. Judge Silva found it on page 10 of her order about the Brady policy and training. So Connick addressed, Is Brady like the situation in Canton about deadly force and law enforcement? They said no. There's no difference in this. That issue is now being raised here to basically revisit Connick. And we would submit, Your Honors, that the county is in a better situation than the defense in Connick as to the evidence in the case. Your Honor, I think I'll have one more point, and if there's any questions, I'm happy to entertain them. Otherwise, I'll submit. But the point I would make is the language that has been cited over and over, and in virtually every case, you can say something about they should have done more on training. In every case. That's what you have here. The training claim, the most tenuous of Monell arguments, not supervision, not discipline, but training, is that when the DA had in-house Brady trainings, they did not circulate a sign-in sheet to have documentary proof about who was there. So when they look back on it 10 years later, at the time that before Mr. Mitchell's retirement and the discovery phase of this case, there was no documents to produce. Oh yeah, maybe in 2020 hindsight, they should have had a sign-in sheet to make sure everybody was there. But the evidence is established that he was barred, he met his CLEs, and he was never disciplined for not attending training. But that's all we have here is in 2020 hindsight, you can come up with something else that should have been done on training. But that does not bridge the gap between a deliberate indifference, knowing effectually, if not full aware, very close, that you're going to have a violation and not taking any steps to ameliorate it. And there's nothing in the record to suggest that there's policymaker deliberate indifference in this case to raise a trial-worthy issue of fact on failure to train. Your Honors, thank you for your time. If you have any questions, I'm happy to entertain them.
Thank you.
I will submit. Thank you.
I'd like to return briefly to the absolute immunity question where my colleague mentioned that the prosecutor relied on a collection of evidence from Metro. But what clearly also had to have happened here, or at least there's a fair question as to whether it happened, is that the prosecutor suppressed exculpatory evidence in front of the grand jury. Otherwise, it's questionable why they would have indicted Mr. Mitch or Mr. Thomas on that count. And the suppression of evidence during the investigatory stage of a prosecution will pierce absolute immunity. So if we can, in good faith, allege, which I think we can based on the evidence in the record, that Mr. Mitchell suppressed exculpatory evidence during the investigatory phase, which it sounds certainly like he did based on the testimony of the sergeant, then that pierces absolute immunity. So based on that, we think there's at least grounds. It was error for the court to say, well, I'm going to say with prejudice because I don't think you're going to be able to do it. Even if he invites you to challenge that later, that's still a with prejudice dismissal. And a with prejudice dismissal does not obligate the party against who it's entered to thereafter file a leave to amend or pursue discovery on the claim. The claim has been dismissed with prejudice, so we're entitled to appeal it. Second, I believe the appellees mentioned that the county is in a better position than the prosecuting office in Connick. I would submit that's false. We have here a prosecutor who has admitted that his understanding was that the Brady policy of his office was to commit violations in actual cases, and then the defendant would complain. And that's how you know whether your prosecutors are trained. If that's the sworn testimony of a prosecutor in your office, and you also have evidence that there is no enforcement mechanism for this training, you have abundant evidence that the county should be aware that there is a risk here. We can't just rely on our prosecutors knowing. I mean, I am a lawyer too. I'm sure I've been acquainted with Brady, but I'm not a prosecutor. So the general training on Brady that I have gotten in my career as a lawyer and my ethical duties as a lawyer would not be sufficient for me to enter into a prosecution and make sure that I am scrupulously complying with a vital constitutional guarantee. And so what happened here is worse than what happened in Connick. And it is that specific circumstance when the county should have been aware that its own failure, it's not just a sign-in sheet. It is the complete absence of any sort of enforcement mechanism. I see I've gone over my time. I think I'm
You're a minute over a minute over.
Okay.
So
I'll leave it at that, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Counsel, thank you both for your arguments this morning. And this case is submitted. And we are adjourned for the week.
Can I add, Judge Force and I have been here all week. Thank you very much for Jen and Sam for coming out and traveling here and doing a great job of supporting us. We appreciate it.